The Ball on the Floor. Hello and welcome to episode 18 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and they'll be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week it's two up top. That means leading the line and wearing the captain's armband is Matthew. So Matthew, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, I've been pretty good. Still getting used to life in the United States, which is good because it takes my mind off Fulham. Somehow managing to, even though we're still in a good position, still not quite as convincing at the top of the Championship as we should be. I think it's now two draws in a row with Derby and Preston. So yeah, hopefully we can sort ourselves out because we've got Bournemouth coming up on Friday night. But other than that, it's all grand.
Ooh, a big game in the Championship, a six-pointer almost. But of course, you're flanked by Palace fan Max. Max, how have you been these past 7 days? I hope all is well.
Yeah, very well, thanks. A bit annoyed after the result on Saturday, but you know, hopefully I can complain about that for some amount of time during the podcast.
Yes, the platform will be there for you to have a little vents later on, so don't worry about that. Before you do that, though, let's do the social media bits, otherwise we'll be talking into the abyss once more. So first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at Real Football Pod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account for that. Also, you can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, I need to mention my content partner, that being betting.com. For all the tips and predictions you'll ever need, visit that website. And the easy way to find all the links is going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. But adopting the R and the E, you get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right, it's time to go live. And where should we go first? Let's go for a bit of glitz and glamour today, I reckon, because last night, that being Monday night, the Ballon d'Or was awarded for 2021. Now, of course, there was a hiatus last year due to all things COVID. You know, football wasn't quite in the position to hand out awards. But Lionel Messi has scooped a seventh orange ball, gold ball, what do you want to call it? It's a gold ball, isn't it? Of course it is, yes. And Matthew, I know you asked off camera, off recording, that you wanted some time allocated to this. The floor is now yours.
Yes, thank you very much. I just want to take it on, not so less in defence of Robert Lewandowski, because I know there's been a lot of talk, you know, on social media in the past 24 hours, you know, how he's been robbed of the award, and how, you know, they should give it to him, not posthumously, retrospectively is the word, 2020 when they didn't have. So I couldn't remember what the right word was. Retrospectively for 2020 when they didn't have the award. But I just, it's just the way that it's all been handled and the way it's been presented. Like Lionel Messi winning the Ballon d'Or, I can understand why, because it's Lionel Messi, greatest player of all time. Yeah, I can get that, and he's had a fantastic year. That's absolutely fine. But what I don't get is why are you giving Robert Lewandowski this Striker of the Year award? It's like, Lionel Messi is also a striker. Surely by default of him being the best player in the world, that also makes him the best striker in the world. But then if you want to go the other way, if Robert Lewandowski is the best striker, he's a better striker than Lionel Messi, then surely Lewandowski should be winning the Ballon d'Or, or at least placing ahead of Lionel Messi in the standings. I just don't get what the whole premise of it was, unless it is entirely to give Robert Lewandowski a consolation trophy. But even then, that wouldn't make sense. So I just find that whole dynamic slightly, you know, slightly weird. You know, I will admit I'm not au fait with all things foreign football, so I'm not one to judge. Oh, Lewandowski scored X amount of goals in the Bundesliga, but it's a harder league, and Lionel Messi scored less goals, but it's split across La Liga and Liga. So how much do you weigh that? I'm not au fait in that, but I just think logically, what it should now. One player should have won both awards, in a sense. It shouldn't have been split in that way. It was a point that I think Roy Smith made on The Times a couple of years ago. It was like, I can't remember who it was, but there should be, if you are nominated for the PFA Player of the Year and PFA Young Player of the Year, then by default, if you win Player of the Year, then you are by default also Young Player of the Year. So it sort of makes it a bit obsolete being named in both categories. So I just found it a bit weird that the awards were split across the two, when surely should have been, you know, both awards should have gone to one of them rather than being split.
Yeah, it's a very salient point you make, and it doesn't really make much sense. So Max, let's try and unravel that. What's your take on this? As Matthew said, is it a consolation prize? Have they sort of gone, well, we kind of know that Lewandowski really should have won it, but Messi's Copa America win holds perhaps a bit more weight because it's an international tournament. Then you could argue it's, 12 teams of not great quality. So that's an argument in itself. But should the Polish hitman have won the award? Or is this kind of, as Matthew says, just a kind of, here you go, here's a trinket just to keep you happy?
Yeah, it's a really, really, really interesting question, right? Because it's just a bit of a complicated situation. I think most people recognise that Lewandowski would and should have won the title last year had it not been kind of deferred for a year because of COVID. And, you know, not many people would have had many arguments about Lewandowski winning it. So the award of the striker of the year thing, it is a little bit of a consolation trophy to him. And I think that even kind of betrays an understanding amongst the people who are voting for it that, you know, Lewandowski probably should have won it last year. But even if you put that aside, because look, you know, it's really, really unfortunate what happened last year, because Lewandowski probably would have been a shoo-in. But, you know, it is a 2021 award. You can't do it based on last year, even though there wasn't an award ceremony last year. But even if you only look at this year, you can still argue that Lewandowski's had a better year. And yeah, of course, I understand, you know, Messi's had a really good kind of season with Barcelona, maybe not so good at PSG, but basically him inspiring the team to kind of Copa America glory is what's done it for him. You know, finally his like curse as the, you know, the poster child of Argentine football is over. You know, finally he's not leveled Maradona, because Maradona's was a World Cup, but finally he's inspired his team to a tournament win, which previously people comparing Maradona and Messi would have said, oh, well, Maradona's done it and Messi hasn't. And so, you know, that was a real crowning moment for Messi in his career. And, you know, it really ranks as one of his best achievements. But, you know, at the same time, Lewandowski has just been, I think, on a different level. And Jonathan Wilson in The Guardian, who I respect a lot, argued quite eloquently, saying, well, you know, Lewandowski scoring a lot of goals in a league that he's clearly too good for, as Bayern, you know, dominate and win the Bundesliga again, you know, for like the 48th year running. It's not that much of an achievement, but, you know, he plays for the side he plays for. It's an individual award. And, you know, Lewandowski will never have the chance really to inspire his team to a tournament win because Poland aren't that good. Whereas Argentina, you know, have the ability across the board to challenge in the Copa America, which, as you say, you know, there are a lot of weaker teams in, or, you know, for example, the World Cup. Whereas Lewandowski will never have the chance to do that. Or if you put Lewandowski in Argentina's team, you know, theoretically, I think he could have scored the goals that led them to Copa America glory. He might have scored more goals or been more effective than Messi. And so I think kind of, although Messi was, you know, the fulcrum of that Argentine team, which won the Copa America, it is still an individual sport. And I think individually, even, you know, if you set aside that Lewandowski should have won it last year, I think Lewandowski was a little bit unlucky in a sense not to be winning it this year. But, you know, if people know that Messi is going to win the Ballon d'Or, then, you know, Lewandowski probably deserves something. But the fact that he's got that like secondary striker award, it's just a bit strange, and it probably betrays to the fact that he should have won the main award, really.
Matthew, is part of the problem also that the Ballon d'Or's timing, that really football doesn't work in a calendar year, or it doesn't work in a calendar year across Europe for sure. So why are we having an award ceremony at the end of a year, which is mid-season? Surely it would make better sense to have it synchronised with the end of the season. So this could be handed out in June, and then it's a fairer reflection on an actual season.
Yeah, absolutely. I do agree with that. I can only think, because when does the voting, because the voting stopped a couple of weeks ago. Like, I can understand if it is based on a season and then, you know, you've got to wait a couple of weeks to get the votes tallied and everything, and ends up being in August or something. I could understand that. But yeah, to hold it in November when, you know, as you say, in the calendar year, and the calendar year isn't even finished. So again, Lionel Messi could go on a five-game streak with that guy. I mean, this is Lionel Messi, probably won't, but you get the point. And Lewandowski could score five hat-tricks in a row, which could have swayed everything entirely. So I do agree with you. The timing is weird, especially now. I suppose it's really to throw a bone, because don't the South American leagues go on a calendar basis?
Yes, that's right.
So yes. I think it might be to throw a bone to that, because I know, because has the Ballon d'Or been going for, I think that this was like the 65th year, it was something like that.
Correct, yeah.
So it probably does include the likes of, you know, when Maradona was playing for Newell's Old Boys and Pele was in was playing in Brazil. So it is probably, you know, a fair compromise. But I do think now, given the shift of power as it has been to European football, and how European football is a September to May or August to May sort of calendar, then it probably would make sense to base it on that rather than, you know, well, to July, because if you want to include tournaments at the end of the year as well, it probably would make sense to switch it to a footballing calendar rather than a January to December calendar.
There you go. If you're listening, Ballon d'Or, we've got the solution for you. But Max, at the same time, could you have made a case for Jorginho to win the award, considering he won both the Champions League with Chelsea, the European Championships with Italy in this 2021 year, or has the, I guess, how should we call it, favourable position tax come against him? Because if you're a defensive midfielder, you haven't really got the glitz and glamour surrounding you. So has that gone against him in the votes?
Yeah, possibly. Because, yeah, I think the proportion of, for example, defenders and goalkeepers who win the Ballon d'Or is very, very low compared to midfielders and attackers, you know, who you'd say probably have the kind of the glory positions, you know, the flair and the creativity and the goals and the assists, and, you know, they tend to kind of dominate the headlines, you know, if they're scoring or not scoring or whatever. Whereas a defender or goalkeeper, for example, who's, you know, quietly excellent for the whole season, like Edouard Mendy, for example, I'm not saying he should have been in contention for the Ballon d'Or, but he's one of the most crucial players in the Chelsea team. But, you know, for example, if Lukaku scores a tap-in in the 85th minute to win it 1-0 and Mendy's made like 9 saves, Lukaku will tend to dominate the headlines. And that has been, you know, reflected throughout the history of the Ballon d'Or. So I think potentially, yeah, the unfavourable position tax, as you say, has counted against Jorginho. I think he definitely should have been in the running for it. But I would still have had Lewandowski ahead of him, but he would have been up there. He would have been up there. And, you know, hopefully we get to a stage where, you know, these are like football journalists voting for it. So, you know, I think they understand that, you know, someone, the best player in a team, can be a defender, even if it's not, you know, the sexiest position. So I think, you know, hopefully we'll get to see more kind of players of that ilk, you know, goalkeepers and defenders winning the award in future. Because, you know, how many times have, you know, players been the best player in the world with a goalkeeper or defender, you know, I don't know, Puyol or Buffon or whoever, and they're not maybe recognised in the way that they should be. But yeah, Jorginho should have been up there this year, but not the winner for me.
Now, there's always quirks when you see the top 30 and you think, how on earth has that player been ranked there? So, Matthew, I'm going to chuck a couple at you. Raheem Sterling, 15. Harry Kane, 23. What do you make of that? Are they in the right order? Should they be higher, lower? What's your take?
Again, I think this does come down to, you know, the flaw of it being in a calendar year rather than a footballing year, because I think no one could really dispute Harry Kane having a better, you know, certainly more, not more accomplished because Sterling won some cups, but yeah, a more productive season than Harry Kane, top scorer and top assist maker in the Premier League in last year. And Raheem Sterling, you know, there were stages where he was out of the side for Manchester City, you know, and was second choice and being used, you know, as a second string player. So that really does baffle me. That is definitely baffling. I think there are, you know, arguably there are more baffling ones than that. Like, I'm sure you're going to mention Cristiano Ronaldo being above Mo Salah, for instance, is a complete joke.
Yeah.
But I think in this instance, yeah, Raheem Sterling to be not just above Harry Kane, but that far above Harry Kane, is a total shocker, and I'll go so far as to say a disgrace, if I'm being honest.
Wow. Yeah, actually, that's not the worst word you could have picked. It's just baffling, really. I think, obviously, City getting to a Champions League final, that holds some weight. Sterling, obviously, then helps England get to the Euros final, holds some weight as well. But again, as you look at Harry Kane, the goals and the assists in the Premier League, and also playing for England and doing a great job there, you kind of think, how's he finished 23rd? I know that's Tottenham bias on my part, but I can't see it myself. And Max, Matthew just mentioned Mo Salah there, 7th. Has the calendar year or the timing gone against him? Will he aim to be, and will he be higher in 2022? Because if you look at what he's done already in this first third of the season, he's kind of on that territory of world's best, isn't he? He hasn't got the Champions League in his hands or a Premier League yet to kind of bouquet this season, but it's going the right way. So if he can win a big prize, he might be a top three player next year.
Yeah, very much. I think he's currently probably the most informed player in the world. And if he maintains this form that he's on, then he's got a really good chance of getting some gongs next season. But as you say, I think that the calendar year thing is difficult, because now for him to win in 2022, he's probably going to have to continue this red hot form for like 10 more months to be considered for 2022. Whereas, yeah, you know, if he has a very slightly kind of under par by his massively high standards, you know, a couple of months in 2022, then someone who has like a really good start to next season, beginning next summer, or, you know, someone who, I'm guessing the Qatar World Cup will be after the next year's awards.
Yes, that would be true.
Yeah. So maybe someone who has a good start in the World Cup, that won't be affected. But, you know, someone who has a really good start to next season, like Salah started this season, someone could kind of come in very late in the race, so to speak, and kind of steam ahead of him. Whereas Salah's obviously, you know, doing really fantastically now. But, you know, such as the parameters of the awards are, Salah's only been this kind of level for a couple of months of this year. So, you know, probably seventh is about right for him. But, you know, I feel a little bit sorry for him, because, you know, just by virtue of the fact that his run of form has come now rather than, say, you know, 4 or 5 months earlier, means that he's probably a little bit lower than he would have wanted to be.
Yes, a very good point, actually, in terms of next year's award, because this is the kind of like dead space, if you will, that if you're kind of performing now, you're still in 2021. So is that going to be even factored into 2022's award? It's kind of the relevance of it all. And as you say, you're kind of then looking at the start of, you know, after Christmas or the start of next season, they're the hot spots. And it's kind of what Salah has done now might be irrelevant come next year. But let's return to Premier League matters as a whole. We're not quite on the field just yet, but Matthew, United, Manchester United that is, have got an interim manager. It's Ralph Rangnick. That's quite the appointment, and one that, when we were discussing this, well, last week before, just named in general, didn't actually come to the fore. So I think they've pulled the wool over all of our eyes, haven't they?
They have, because when you look at the names that have been, you know, Ten Hag was being mentioned, Pochettino was being mentioned. There were managers who were, you know, who had jobs elsewhere, as it were, which is why a lot of talk was about Conte, because he was a free agent. But yeah, for them to go with Rangnick, it's an okay appointment. You just look at his track record, and you just think, is he, again, this is the same thing with Solskjaer, the same is with a couple of players they brought. Is he the guy to take them over the top? Is he the guy that took them to take them from second in the Premier League to serious challenges and winning the Premier League? Is he the guy to take them, you know, in the Champions League, then, you know, get them further in the Champions League, or depending on how it works, to win the Europa League for them? I just don't see it. And I'm also not a fan of the he's been interim manager. He's named as an interim manager. Like, how's that going to affect, you know, players that they want to bring? Because, you know, you assume they're going to want to be busy in January and stuff, you know, to try, again, bring players that are going to put them over the top. But are players going to want to join knowing that, you know, he's an interim, so they're going to have to change a manager at the end of the season? So can they really be, you know, invested in what Rangnick in what he offers them? I just don't think it makes sense for a whole host of reasons.
Max, it is a safe pair of hands, but, you know, do United need more than that? But of course, we've discussed the limitations they have in terms of names, so they've kind of gone down this route as the only one they can get. So is it more about the consultancy role that he's then due to morph into at the start of next season? Is that really the kind of the golden appointment and all this, it's not really the interim element now, it's what's to follow for the next man.
Yeah, I think so. I think it's just about laying the foundations now, because, you know, I think we were talking about it last week, weren't we, or the week before, saying, you know, it is early enough in the season that you can't just call the season a complete write-off. But, you know, is he going to win the Premier League for them? No. And that's ultimately going to be their goal. Will he win the domestic cup? You know, possibly. But basically, it's just about kind of instilling the right kind of culture, the right kind of mentality, because, you know, he's obviously performed both roles as both a manager and like a director of football, you know, sporting director. And so, you know, there are question marks over whether he can do, you know, the real like nitty gritty day to day meat and drink, say, of a manager rather than director of football. But I think, as you say, his most important role at the club, you know, when we look over Rangnick's tenure at United in, say, 10 years, I think the most important thing that he does will not be his work where he's working as a manager now, just as like a stopgap until they get Zidane or, you know, Conte once Tottenham fire him or whoever. So, yeah, I think for now it's just about, you know, kind of stabilising the club. I actually think it's a pretty astute kind of short-term move, because it's just about kind of stabilising the ship. He's a very strong tactical mind, whereas, you know, Solskjaer probably wasn't. And I'm sure we'll see United improve. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, they want to be challenging for titles. That is what it's going to be the brief for the manager that comes in the summer, whoever that is. But, you know, they know that that's already gone for this season, really. And I think, you know, they recognise that they're probably not going to get anywhere near the Champions League. But, you know, possibly they'll have a chance in one or two of the cups. And I think as long as he sets them up, you know, well and gets them well drilled and, you know, their mentality is a little bit stronger, and, you know, they start competing in the really big games, as long as there's a kind of improvement, that'll be his main goal, I reckon.
Well, Max, I'll stay with you because you kind of tiptoed around who that man might be that takes over in the summer. Who do you reckon that man will be? Because it's not a case of necessarily slotting in a world-class manager. It's got to be someone who, I guess, is linked to Rangnick's ethos and coaching style. So there'll be some continuity there. So who does that man become? Because I've heard Ralf Hasenhüttl linked, but I thought, well, that's a bit of a reach. But is it going to be someone a bit more left field, or will they try and go down the Zidane route and then try and fuse the two elements together?
Yeah, that's interesting, right? Because I think it should be someone who is, you know, kind of espousing the Rangnick ideals, if that's what they've pinpointed as, you know, what they need. It's possible that United have just thought of a, you know, not a bad bunch, but of the bunch who are available to take over until the rest of the season. Rangnick is the most experienced. He's the safest. You know, we'll probably do best under him. If, you know, that might just be a kind of a hard-nosed decision from United to say, right, you know, regardless of his like tactical ideas, we just reckon he's the safest pair of hands. In that case, then, you know, they could end up going for, you know, they won't go necessarily for someone who's tied to the Rangnick kind of ideas and tactics and fundamentals and stuff. If they have actually, as a club, thought, right, well, we want to play the way that Rangnick has set up his teams, you know, say RB Leipzig and that kind of thing, and, you know, targeting young players and, you know, high pressure football and, you know, really exciting, entertaining, quick, direct, all of those kind of things, then they should go for someone who is kind of following those kind of ideas. And as you say, Hasenhüttl is a bit of a stretch. I'd be extremely surprised if they went for him, but they could go for someone in that kind of mould who tries to play at least that kind of football. And it would be really interesting, actually, to see whether they do go for that, whether they, you know, they stick to their principles, or if they just pick off the biggest name that is available, whether that's Zidane or Pochettino, you know, regardless of whether they kind of fit into the club ideals. And I think that would be a really interesting decision for United. If they have decided that they want, you know, the Rangnick principles in their club, then I think they should go for a manager who is, wedded to those ideals rather than just getting Zidane, for example, which is kind of typical of the thinking that has led them to this point, is it's like very social media. Oh, Zidane's the biggest name, therefore we're going to go for Zidane, you know, with no idea about how he's going to fit in at the club or anything like that.
Matthew, with Ranić becoming a consultant at the start of next season, is that a bit of a hindrance? I know we're kind of lauding it as a masterstroke from the Red Devils, but if you're a consultant, you're not a director of football, you kind of have influence, but it's not really kind of, you're just kind of there, you're a presence. But is that presence going to also be a case of too many cooks spoiling the broth in the end?
I think it could be. I mean, we're saying this, for all we know, consultant could just be Man United's way of, sexing up the name director of football, somebody who have sporting director. It could, for all we know, it could very well be the same, the same job, just in a different word. But if we are to, but to follow up that line of question, I think it would, because I think there needs to be, some sort of order in streamlining. This is why, you've got to say you want to have a director of football who's in charge of the transfers and everything, and the manager, who are on the same wavelength. I think if you have a consultant and then a director of football, because there's all sorts of various roles at Manchester United, because you've got, academy managers, because the academy is very important to Manchester United, plus the first team manager and all that sort of stuff. I think you are in danger of having, too many of these. And whilst, it is okay to have too many ideas in certain cases, because you want to get more ideas floating to the top, when you are in a situation like Manchester United are, when they need to get, back on track as soon as possible, as it were, I think you do need some sort of, order rather than chaos. I think having too many ideas could potentially bring. So, I think they are in that danger. Again, following along your question, that it's a consultant and not a director of football.
Yeah, it's a very fair point, actually. I didn't think of the sexing up of the term. It could just be that he is the man above, whether that's a man that slots in between him and the manager. We'll have to wait and see. But working on the basis that there's also a director of football to follow, it could get a bit messy. But Matthew, I'll stay with you, because we should give honourable mention to Michael Carrick. I know last week we sort of said that whoever the interim man in that most short-term bracket is just needs to sort of do a job very quickly and do it well. And I think he's done exactly that. A safe passage through to the Champions League round of 16, and also a well-earned point away to Chelsea on Sunday.
Yeah, I think well-earned point is very well done, because I think in given that situation, barring Manchester City or Liverpool, it is really, you couldn't have asked for a harder test for someone like Michael Carrick for his first Premier League, for his first Premier League game in charge. It means he's got Arsenal coming up in a couple of days, but that's going to be tough. But yeah, and especially given the situation, because I was watching the highlights, and I don't know if it's the way NBC presented it, but it did seem as if Chelsea were thoroughly dominating Manchester United and just wasted their chances. But you can only play what's in front of them. Yeah, he set up very well. The decision to not play Cristiano Ronaldo, whilst it caused a bit of a debate between Keane and Carragher, appears to have been the right one, because they managed to get a point. But I think, all credit to him in the situation that he is, knowing that it could very well have been his last game. He went out on something of a high. So, in all fairness, all credit to him for getting what he could out of the game.
Max, what would you like to talk about? You can talk about the Ronaldo offside decision at the very end, or you can talk about Keane and Carragher going to war. What would you like?
Oh, I'll have a little bit on both of that, sorry.
Yeah, go on then. So, first up, the Ronaldo offside. What's the assistant referee doing there? Should the flag gone up or stayed down?
So it shouldn't have gone up initially, according to the rules, which are, you should allow the play to develop, rather than putting the flag up, it being wrong, and, the team might have scored from it. So I completely understand that rule, even though, a lot of fans are up in arms about it. That rule completely makes sense to me. However, when it gets to the point that a corner is given away, you then have to say, actually, it was initially offside. We've played it out. They haven't scored. It was offside. Free kick, Chelsea. And then, from that point, it should have been given to Chelsea. On the Keane and Carragher stuff, I just thought it was absolutely hilarious. I mean, I don't know. I felt there was an element of kind of performativeness, if that's a word, from Carragher. I think Keane is just genuinely like that as a human being, as a man. Whereas I think Carragher was probably hamming it up a little bit. I don't know if he's kind of been told to be a bit more controversial or anything like that. You don't know what Sky is saying to them, or whether they're just saying, go out and be yourself. But I just felt like that I don't know. It was a little bit strange from Carragher because he just kind of kept asking the same question over and over, and Keane had obviously given him the answer that he want. You know, Ronaldo didn't come to United to win the league because they're too far off it, which is true. But they could still win a couple of domestic cups, which is also true. You know, and Carragher kind of didn't see that. So I just thought it was a little bit weird. I mean, amazing for Sky. You know, they so many times on their YouTube. You know, highlights of the pundit videos, they talk about heated debates and whatever in capital letters, but this actually was a heated debate. Finally, you know, they could actually put that term on it, and it was right. But I mean, yeah, it was just probably a bit of a much ado about nothing.
Matthew, I know you're logged into NBC coverage at the moment, but you must have seen this war of words across social media. Do you think Sky are ramping up the pantomime, maybe to the detriment of what we're seeing in terms of analysis? It's great for clicks, it's great for traction across social media, but is it also a risk of dumbing down in terms of coverage?
I think there is that case if it becomes too much of a regular thing. Like, I know, for instance, Graeme Souness, he gets a lot of... Like, I personally don't mind Graeme Souness. I don't mind Roy Keane with their rants. And, I mean, Roy Keane has become, you know, a cult icon in sort of for social media and Twitter because of the way he acts. It's okay. I just don't want to see it happen every single week. Like, no, once a month is absolutely fine. It's, I don't want to say too much of a good thing, but it is that sort of sense. I really like Jamie Carragher and Gary Neville, the debates they have on Monday Night Football. I love it. I love the fact that, and it's once a week. It's something you can get used. I wouldn't want to see it every single week because it sort of decreases the specialness of it. So I think so long as these are kept to, you know, once a month or once every 2 months, I think it's okay. I don't want to see it happen every single week. You know, I'm not seeing Soccer Saturday, but on Soccer Saturday and then pre-game before the 4 o'clock and then after the 4 o'clock and then after the Monday Night Football, I don't want to see it become a regular thing. I think the odd time, especially in the way that the world is with, you know, as you say, clicks and sensationalism, it's okay, but so long as it doesn't become the norm, then I think it's fine.
Yeah, I'd agree. You want it from time to time because it keeps things interesting and it keeps you hooked. But if you can sort of see it in front of your own eyes and thinking, hang on, this is debate for debate's sake, you kind of then know it's going the wrong way. But I think the balance is just about right. And Sky, as I say, will be lapping this one up. You know, this is the perfect content that can be disposed across the internet. So more power to them. But Matthew, it's power to Chelsea, but it's being diminished because two more drop points in the title race. And it means that a title race is starting to shape up at just the right time of the season, because we're going into December tomorrow when we record this. That's Wednesday tomorrow night. And this really is the most pivotal month of the Premier League season.
Yeah, it does seem like two drop points, especially as you mentioned, the way the title race is going. I think, listen to some people, I think they are. It is now starting to become, as much as we said, you know, I think we said before the start of the season, so long as Chelsea can sort their forward problems out, because that was the problem under Tuchel last year. They had a great defence, but strike, it just wasn't quite there. And obviously with Lukaku out, it's causing a bit of a problem. You can sort of see where they are starting to fall off. Because if Lukaku's not there, then who is picking up the slack? And you know, you saw the performance on Sunday, and so many wasted chances. If Lukaku's not there, someone has to fill that role, and no one at Chelsea at the moment is doing that. So you can sort of see why it is now becoming a two horse race between Liverpool and Manchester City, unless Chelsea finally, you know, start to kick into gear. But it would be very tough ask for them, probably at this stage. That's why December is very much, as you say, going to be a crucial month for them.
Well, Max, that's now two home draws in the last three outings for Chelsea. So a few weeks ago, I spoke about Chelsea and their system and everyone doing that bit perfectly instead of one world-class player carrying the load and sort of taking them to new heights. So as we sort of come to the conclusion that the system was fantastic and is working, but is that also going to be the thing that undoes them in the second half of the season, that without that player taking the club on their shoulders and thrusting them up to the top of the table or keeping them there, that might be their downfall?
Yeah, potentially, because then, you know, once the system is kind of resolved and you know that you're going to play that every week and, you know, you're just going to slot in whoever's fit or available, you then do need the players to kind of individually deliver. And you know, we're seeing not only is Lukaku a miss, I think Lukaku is less of a miss than Kante, you know, and or Kovacic in centre mid, because Loftus-Cheek, really good player. Glad he's getting more chances for Chelsea. But Kante and Kovacic are different level, you know. And And United kind of packed the midfield with, you know, the three defensive midfielders, McTominay, Matic and Fred. And, you know, I think if Chelsea had had Kovacic in there, they'd have won the game. If they'd had Kovacic or Kante in there, just rather than Loftus-Cheek, I think they probably would have won the game because, you know, the control that those two players give them in midfield is, you know, really crucial. And so, you know, if you do take a couple of players out of their team, they are kind of weakened to the point where, you know, they might occasionally struggle to get the result over the line. But to be fair, you could say that about Liverpool and City as well.
Well, Matthew, I've looked at Chelsea's goals this season, 31, which is an impressive tally, no bones about that. But their top scorer in the league is Reece James with 4. Next up, Ben Chilwell and a few others join, 3. Now, that's great for the wing-backs, it's great for the system and all of that, but that's a damning indictment of their attackers at the moment.
I think it is. It is a sort of there are two sides of it. I mean, you can make the argument that at least they're getting goals from everywhere. You know, as I said, Romelu Lukaku, whilst he's not getting the goals that, you know, he really should have been, that he really should be getting, that, you know, someone else is stepping up. But the fact that it's coming from the wing backs and rather than the likes of Timo Werner and Pulisic and Mount and Havertz and all that lot, it is something, as you say, something of an indictment of the fact that, you know, if they were just, you know, a little bit better, then they could be turning these draws into win and be putting up more of a fight. So yeah, I think it is something that, you know, really should be, you know, dressing room talk, you know, stick on the newspaper sort of thing. But it should really be a kick up the backside for the forward players to say, right, these guys are doing it, why aren't you?
Well, Max, Romelu Lukaku isn't doing it by his own standards. Is it too early to call him a Chelsea flop? Will he be added to the list of world-class forwards that have come to Stamford Bridge and their careers have slightly withered away?
Yeah, I think it's significantly too early to make those kind of calls, I reckon. By his own standards at Inter, he probably hasn't quite delivered yet, but, you know, that's understandable. He has been in English football before, but it is obviously an adjustment again to come back to it, having played in Serie A, which is, you know, a slower pace, probably less physically demanding as well. And, you know, getting used to his new teammates and all that kind of thing. And, you know, if he'd played all these last however many weeks he's been injured, 4 or 5 weeks he's been injured, and, you know, he played kind of badly and struggled and not scored in any of them, then I'd say, okay, yeah, he's in bad form, you know. He'll definitely be wanting to pick it up. But, you know, he's been troubled a little bit with injury. When he was playing regularly in the team, you know, he was scoring goals. So I think, yeah, once he's back to his best, and Tuchel said it himself, like, once he's back and fit and available, he is a starter. And, you know, when he is back and fit and available and starting games regularly, I think the goals will follow.
Now, in terms of the title race, it seems as if routine wins were the order of the day for both Liverpool and Manchester City. Matthew, Liverpool were at home once again, a 4-0 thrashing of Arsenal last weekend, or the weekend before last, shall I say, a 4-0 win against Southampton weekend just gone. It's fair to say that after that defeat to West Ham, they're reminding everyone of their title credentials.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems like they are bouncing back at, you know, just the right time. You know, now that the games are going to start coming thick and fast with the winter fixtures, this is where, you know, you can really easily start to get momentum. And, you know, one win becomes two, becomes three, becomes four, and that's when Liverpool will start, you know, will look to start to pull away, you know, as will Manchester City as well. And, you know, Liverpool really, you know, arguably need these wins as much as, you know, as much as they can to get as many points on the board, because they are going to be hit hard when it comes to the African Cup of Nations with likes of Salah and Mane having to leave. So they need to get as many points on the board as possible, because I don't think off the top of my head, I don't think Manchester City are going to be hit as hard. I can only think of Riyad Mahrez maybe, again off the top of my head. So yeah, they're going to need to put in as many points as they can to get sort of develop as much of a cushion as they can before, you know, the tough times are going to come when it comes to January losing players.
Well, Max, that's an excellent point, actually, and one I didn't really factor in. I was going to mention the fact that when you look at Liverpool's front three, replacing Jota for Firmino, they've scored nearly two-thirds of Liverpool's goals this season in the league. So that's the kind of counterbalance to the team as a whole, or the squad as a whole, scoring goals. This is concentrated into three players doing their job really well. But if you take two-thirds of that equation out of the window for, what, January, February in the new year for the AFCON, is that going to really hit Liverpool? Because their backup options, I don't know what, Origi, Minamino, they're nowhere near what Salah and Mane can do.
Yes, you're right. I think they would probably be able to handle the absence of one of those two, because Jota is class. And, you know, he will be the future of the Liverpool attack to come. But the absence of both will be difficult because, as you say, you know, even if they play Jota and Firmino, and even if Jota and Firmino are fit for the whole time that Salah and Mane are away, there's still another slot that needs to be filled. Minamino is all right. Origi is all right, but they're not, you know, Premier League winning forwards, or that, you know, if you played them every single week, I don't think Liverpool would win the title, basically. No. Even if, you know, they might have a Premier League title winning medal, for example. But yeah, the drop off after that is quite significant. Now, it'll be interesting to see what he does. You know, will he just say to Minamino, right, you've got a slot in the team on the right, Jota's on the left, Firmino's up front, that's my front three. Will he play Oxlade-Chamberlain there? He has done it at some points. You know, will he play... And he actually tried Neco Williams at, you know, right attack or, you know, right wing, didn't he? Which is interesting because he's been doing really well for Wales, although at left wing back, you know, a completely different position. But how they handle that will, you know, potentially decide the title this year, because being without those two is so crucial, not only in terms of goals and assists, obviously, but those two are really, really clued up on the Liverpool pressing as well. And, you know, they really lead from the front with that kind of thing. And obviously they're going to be gigantic losses. And yeah, maybe he'll look to strengthen in January, or at least, you know, maybe bring in a loan or something just so he has another kind of body there to help out.
Well, Matthew, let's think outside the box here. Could you use Trent Alexander-Arnold as an auxiliary forward across the month of January or February?
I think that is very much thinking outside of the box. I think... He pretty much does play as a winger rather than a fullback, given the way he plays. But I just think making, you know, winger in the traditional David Beckham number seven sense rather than the modern sense of wide forward, as it were. I think it would be good to use him for one game as a thing, but I can't see it being a consistent thing, because whilst he certainly would be able to be providing crosses and providing assists with his fantastic right foot, I think when it comes to finishing and being in and around the box, and, you know, what Mo Salah is able to bring with his, you know, with his dancing feet, as it were, with 2 goals in 2 weeks against like Everton and Watford, I think it was, earlier on in the season, I just don't see him being able to recreate that. I think he'll be able to get the assists, sure, but when it comes to goals, I think you really do need someone with a forwards instinct, as it were, to take on that role. I mean, again, he could play as a winger if Jurgen Klopp wants to switch formations around, but if he wants to play as 4-3-3 with the interchanging three as they work, I don't think Alexander-Arnold is quite built to take on that role.
Well, Max, could it be a change of formation? We know Liverpool's MO, really, isn't it? The 4-3-3, but needs must and all that. So could it be just two up top, Origi, Minamino, well, actually, no, it wouldn't be them, Firmino, Jota, and then building a midfield around that with an advanced TAA, and then, I don't know, even Robertson further forward. Can they just tilt things in that aspect?
You know what? I don't think they would go... They might go two up top. They might try and change formation around. I think what they might do... more likely, rather than having, you know, like a 4-4-2 or whatever, I think they might go to wing backs. They might just add an extra centre back in there, because Konate is really good, Matip is really good, Gomez is really good, and he's coming back from injury, obviously. If you have two of them and Van Dijk, you know, then that gives Alexander-Arnold and Robertson the license to get forward. Both of them are obviously class in attack. And then, you know, you have two players in midfield. You wouldn't maybe have the same you'd have three in midfield with two up top, wouldn't you? Yeah, so you could have, you know, Henderson, Thiago, Fabinho, maybe Oxlade-Chamberlain, you know, maybe Curtis Jones coming back from injury, Keita as well, all of those players kind of vying for a spot, and then the two up front, you know, that might work, rather than kind of trying to shoehorn in Minamino or Williams or pushing Alexander-Arnold further forward, which I don't think would necessarily work.
OK, let's look at Man City now, because they're a point behind Chelsea. And Matthew, we spoke weeks ago when they were 5 points behind Chelsea, and we surmised that maybe Pep might have to go for that blockbuster signing to reel them in. It looks like he's reeling them in without that blockbuster signing. That said, will he still open the purse strings in January?
I think he will, especially with the news surrounding Ferran Torres, because there's talk like, don't Barcelona want to bring him in?
Again,
I don't know how Manchester City work financial fair play wise, but you can make the argument that if they could get, say, I saw a figure being batted around at 40 million, I can't remember if it was pounds or euros, but if they can get something along that way for Ferran Torres, which doesn't seem too far fetched, because I do think he does have a very good future behind him, and when you consider his age and what he can bring, 40 million isn't too far fetched.
Yeah, it's about fair.
If they bring in 40 million and then use that as down payment, as it were, to bring in, for the sake of the argument, an Erling Haaland or an Mbappe or I was going to say Neymar, but he's injured, but a player of that, a big signing of that ilk, then, you know, someone who can deliver them now for them now rather than in the future, I wouldn't rule it out, just because we know how ruthless he's been, and especially if he can sense blood in the water with Liverpool being down Mane and Salah, as we've discussed. If he can say, right, if they can drop just 3 or 4 points in January, which again isn't out of the realms of possibility, if he thinks, right, they're going to be dropping points, we need to be capitalising, I need someone I can guarantee to get goals, then I can see that. Yeah. Again, pie in the sky, but say he turns that 40 million into 40 million that's to pay for Harry Kane, it's a possibility. I don't think you can rule it out just because we know how ruthless Pep Guardiola can be when the chips are down, he needs to be.
Well, Max, obviously Matthew's just mentioned Ferran Torres, and that could go ahead, you know, it's a bit of a indifferent source, but it's not outside the realm of possibility. At the same time, there's no doubt that Man City have a lot of interchangeable forwards that are struggling for consistent game time due to Pep's likeness for chopping and changing, as is his right to do. However, Raheem Sterling is kind of in favour, he's out of favour, his future's up in the air, it's secure. Do you reckon he could be off in January to fund these big moves that Matthew just mentioned?
So I know Barcelona are really interested in him, or at least, you know, they've been linked with him. If Barcelona had the money to buy Sterling, I would say, potentially Guardiola would look at doing that. But I think he only wants to lose one of those, probably one player from his forward line. You know, it's already looking a little bit, you know, slightly weak, or, you know, maybe there's a lack of depth up there of like real quality options. When you think, you know, he's playing a lot of midfielders as forwards and stuff like that. So I think, you know, he'd probably be open to losing one of maybe Mahrez, Sterling, Torres. With it looking like that's going to be Torres, yeah, I think he'll be wanting to keep Sterling. And Sterling, you know, has done really, really well for Guardiola in the past. It's not like he's an unproven player. He's been doing fantastically for England all of this time that he's been kind of in and out of the City team. And now, I mean, it looks like he's had a couple of starts, he's had a couple of goals in a row. I think he's pretty much back in favour with Guardiola.
Okay, let's mop up the rest of the Premier League action from the weekend now. And Matthew, we keep saying it, but Newcastle really do look doomed now. And I know we don't really look into the future on this podcast, but there's some midweek P League action to follow on the other end of this podcast. So if they can't beat Norwich tonight, that being Tuesday, then surely not even a big bag of money can save them in January.
Yeah, it is very much a case of running out of games, because as much as you want to say, oh, you know, Eddie Howe with his first game against Brentford, oh, how unfortunate he missed the game because he had COVID, so he wasn't there to, you know, manage the team properly from the sideline. Okay, you want to give him the thing for that. Okay, away to Arsenal, yeah, they were probably going to lose that anyway. They're running out of excuses, as it were. So I think when it comes to a game, you know, as they're playing Norwich City tonight, I don't want to say 6-pointer. You could argue 6-pointer, but when it comes to, you know, season defining game, you've got to think, right, there is no more excuses. Eddie Howe should be, you know, Eddie Howe is back on the touchline tonight. It's against Norwich, who are a relegation rival, who, you know, and now you've got everything. I think for the vast majority of the players, I think there's like one or two, but the vast majority of the key players are fit and healthy. This has to be it. If you can't get a win now, to at least gather some momentum for the December games. If it's not going to come now and tonight, as we record tonight, then you really are then there really is no hope, despite, as you say, how much money they can spend on players. Good. It is going to look very much like a lost cause if they can't even beat Norwich. And again, nothing against Norwich, but the situation that they're in, if they can't beat a team that's around them, then what hope do they have?
Well, of course, yes. They've got Norwich tonight being Tuesday, Burnley at the weekend, both at home. I think Newcastle needs 6 points out of that. No shakes about it, because then their run on the other side of those two matches is absolutely horrendous. And as you say, Matthew, we've gone through the book of excuses. There is nothing left. They've got to get to win. And if they can't beat Norwich, then you're looking at it and just thinking, well, I think this could be the richest team ever to play in the Championship. But Max, Everton aren't quite heading towards that direction, but they're not doing too good at the moment either, because they're 7 games without a win. Rafa Benitez feeling the strain, which was always going to be the case if they went under a bad run with him being ex-Liverpool. But if they suffer a midweek Merseyside derby defeat to Liverpool, do you reckon Benitez could be out the door?
Yeah, firstly, on Newcastle, if they do go down, you know, talk about Project 114 in the Championship. They're going to spend $100 million and win every game 18-0, aren't they? That's going to be mad.
What would that be? Hang on, what's the maths? Project 138. So that's next season.
Yeah, there you go. Right. Yeah, so that'd be crazy. But to be honest, I don't think... I mean, obviously, Benitez being an ex-Liverpool man and, you know, therefore kind of starting off probably on the wrong foot with Everton... it doesn't help him, but at the same time, as emotive as losing the Merseyside derby will probably be for them when they probably lose, you know, Benitez being an ex-Liverpool man, again, as I said, I don't think, you know, losing that game will be the end of it for him. They've obviously been in really bad form, but for example, I think the Brentford game will be more damaging to him because, you know, it's a newly promoted side and, I mean, Brentford weren't amazing. I was live blogging that game. Brentford weren't amazing, but they kind of shut Everton out quite easily. I understand they've had injuries to, and you know, suspensions to Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison, who are obviously massive misses in attack, and they've had, you know, lots of injuries as well at the back and stuff like that. But losing to Liverpool, that's kind of just expected because of where the two clubs are at the moment. You know, Everton haven't really been doing well in Merseyside derbies recently. Just because Liverpool are top class and Everton are a fair way off that. So I don't think losing will be, you know, the catalyst for them to sack him, unless it's like a really, really insipid performance and they get absolutely spanked like 5-0 or something.
Well, Matthew, Everton are 7 without a win. Brighton are now 8 without a win. We spoke about Brighton being Brighton last week and how it's just kind of, it's what they do. But after their draw at home to Leeds on Saturday evening, there was some boos towards Graham Potter. Are they rightful? And also, I know Potter came out and sort of challenged them. So is he right to challenge the boos? What do you make of all of this?
No, I think he is absolutely right, because I don't want to accuse Brighton fans, but it seemed to me what Graham Potter was sort of saying, so I think I can get away with it, of being, you know, ungrateful for where they've come. You know, Brighton are, you know, were to an extent punching above themselves in the league when they were in the... Did they ever reach the top six earlier in the season?
Yes, they
were.
Yeah, they were high up.
Yeah,
they did.
Yeah, exactly. Earlier up in the season, so I think, you know, whilst they might be thinking, oh, this might be something and again, I don't want to be rude to them, but in aspect, they are still. It is still Brighton. You know, it is still a side that, you know, for a couple of years was just teetering on the edge of being relegated, and, you know, were 15th, 16th, 17th. In the league. So whilst the first spurt of the season did take them up towards the European places, we all knew that it was going to peter out eventually. And as long as they can, you know, stay, you know, even if they do suffer the blip that they are going through now, if they can finish, you know, 10th, 11th, 12th, that is still some level of, you know, of progress. And whilst we probably don't expect Brighton to be, you know, turned into the next Leicester, as it were, you know, even that would still be a relative success for a club that, you know, the size of Brighton, for instance. So I do think Graham Potter was right. I think the fans were wrong to the fans were wrong to boo, and Graham Potter was right to, you know, sort of call them out in that way.
Well, I used to live in Brighton and I've got some experience. I used to have a Brighton season ticket actually when they're in the Championship. And one of the criticisms that Potter has levelled to the fans is that the atmosphere is was poor. He says that Brighton want to be a top 10 team, but the atmosphere is nowhere near the same level. So that needs to sort of help the team. But what he kind of alludes to is that with Brighton, a lot of people get Brighton tickets because it's kind of Premier League football on your door. Oh, we'll go and watch a bit of football, but they're probably Liverpool, Man United fans, Chelsea fans, and it's just kind of a bit of entertainment. They're not actually really the diehard of Brighton. There are diehard fans there, of course, but a percentage of that populace that go to the ground every weekend or every fortnight, shall I say, aren't really Brighton fans, and I think that's probably holding them back a little bit, that their coaching is great. Obviously, they're not quite getting the wins, or they're not getting wins because they're not winning eight, but the atmosphere helps. It's no kind of secret that atmosphere and the 12th man across the country or wherever you go is always going to be worth a couple of points along the way, and I think that's just not quite in tune with the club at the moment. So, yeah, I think a fan has always got his own sort of right to boo, but I think, as Potter also said, it's that silent minority which are kind of ruining it for everyone else. So watch how that sort of pans out. But I think Brighton fans need to do their bit to help the club along. Max, Aston Villa, their new manager bounce continues under Steven Gerrard, unfortunately at the expense of your beloved Palace. Now, there's a referee who made his Premier League debut. I think his name was Michael Salisbury. I think that's his name. If it's not, I apologise. But I don't think he had the best of showings. What did you make?
Yeah, quickly on the Brighton side, it's absolutely music to my ears, you two having a go at them. but I'm actually furious that you used to be a Brighton season ticket holder. I'm never coming back, mate. I'm gone. You'll never hear me on the pod again. But
I said too much.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, yeah, the ref wasn't the reason we lost. Palace played poorly and, you know, below themselves, or, you know, below their performances this season. MacArthur and Anderson are big misses, so let me get that out of the way first. But the ref was shocking, and it was Michael Salisbury.
Right.
And it's tough because obviously refereeing is a very, very, very difficult job at the highest level, right? And, you know, you can't keep going with the same Premier League refs forever. You need to introduce some new blood. And I guess the way that you do that is by promoting them from the Championship and kind of seeing how they do. It was just Palace's bad fortune that, you know, I don't know Salisbury as a referee, or, you know, personally or anything. I'm sure he's done well in the Championship, which is why they've promoted him to give him a Premier League game or something. And he might be a very good referee, and he might prove to be a very good referee in a long, distinguished career. But he was really poor in the game. And not only against Palace, he gave a weird straight red to Douglas Luiz that turned out to be very little contact in, which was correctly overturned as well. So, you know, I'm not only saying, oh, he was completely anti-Palace. It just seemed like he was a bit overawed by the occasion, maybe. Yeah. And, you know, it's understandable on your first Premier League game, but it's obviously frustrating from a Palace perspective because, you know, he was refereeing the game a bit strangely. You know, at some points he was letting a lot go. And I understand that, you know, that's how referees are going these days. You know, they're allowing a bit more contact. Fine, all well and good. But then at other points, you know, Villa were diving for quick, easy free kicks and he was giving every single one of them. Yeah, it was just a frustrating afternoon from a Palace perspective, and that wasn't really helped at all by him. But, you know, Villa were really, really frustrating team to watch because, you know, after they were ahead, they essentially weren't interested in playing football. They were just, you know, diving around and time wasting, you know, really to ridiculous levels. And I actually haven't seen it much before, but you know the rule that refs have to stop it if there's a head injury. Basically, Villa would just go down clutching their head as if they were injured, even if, you know, their heads weren't hitting a tackle, even if it was like a foot-to-foot tackle. And the ref was just kind of forced to stop it. And, that, you know, that's quite an effective but cynical way of playing. You know, Martinez caught the ball in his hands and, you know, went down as if he'd done his ACL. And then was down for 3 or 4 minutes and then got up again and booted the ball the length of the pitch, you know, so his leg can't have been that bad. And it was just frustrating to watch. And look, I understand every team does it, right? Every team time wastes, including Villa, including Palace, every team does it. But it was just the extent to which they were doing it and how early in the game. And it was just really poor to watch. And so I wasn't too happy about that. It was overall frustrating. But, you know, Palace will bounce back. MacArthur and Anderson are big misses and, you know, onwards and upwards.
Talking of poor to watch, Norwich versus Wolves, an incredibly boring game, even with highlights. So, Matthew, to be honest, I don't think Norwich fans will care that much because it's another point on the board. Their mini resurgence continues.
They could be, you know, when you consider that, you know, whilst it is a 0-0 draw, it is a 0-0 draw against a Wolves side who have been in incredibly good form of note. So it's not as if they, it was some, you know, crumb bum team. I think they can absolutely take positivity from that, and Dean Smith, you know, is getting them in the right direction, which I think, as we've said before, is really all you can ask from, because it was mission impossible when he took them over. He may keep them up, you know, but if he's giving them at least a decent chance, then that's all really that we can ask of. It does sound a bit patronizing, but that's all that we can really ask of him and the Norwich team. So if he can keep them up like keep playing like this, then all credit to him.
And Max, finally, Leicester versus Watford. A decent win for the Foxes. But I think one thing we can all take from this, how fun is football in the snow?
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It was just so weird, you know, seeing it coming down. And visibility was like, not weirdly, but it was weird to watch because visibility was very bad and it was difficult to see the pitch. I mean, it made sense, obviously, with snow being on the pitch. But yeah, it was you know, it was new and exciting and unusual. And so, yeah, it added a nice element of drama to the weekend.
Well, there was no drama at Turf Moor because Burnley versus Tottenham was snowed off with 50 minutes remaining before kickoff. Now, whether there was undersoil heating at the pitch, I don't think there is. Some are saying that Burnley should have that. You know, this is the Premier League and all that. But also, there's also an argument that Burnley had some injuries and thought, actually, we don't really fancy this. Let's not heat up the pitch. Max, do you reckon that's true?
I don't think so. I think maybe, you know, it might be fun for kind of Wags to suggest on social media, but, you know, that they'll have wanted the game to happen. And I'm sure, you know, being Burnley, they would have quite enjoyed, you know, hosting a team in awful conditions and seeing how they, you know, matched up to the challenge. So I don't think there's any truth in that.
Matthew, did you see the man who travelled from Dallas to Burnley 31 hours to see no football?
I do. You do get these stories. In fact, you are almost waiting for whenever a game is called off. You are waiting to see right who's come the furthest. We are getting into December now. There is going to be more snow. Expect there to be a story of someone from China or Australia because it does seem to be a case of right who's going to one up the previous fan. And it, I mean, whether or not they're doing it to sort of get some form of compensation for the club, because again, in the world that we live in, you know, I've seen Harry Kane do something. Whether or not it is a, you know, desperate cry for attention, or if it is just genuinely, you know, trying to make fun of the situation, it's either one. But yeah, it is what happens every single time, and you know, you just wait to see what happens when the next one comes around.
Right, talking of time, we've hit full time, so I just need to do the admin, which is as simple as thanking my two Pod Squad members. Max, a sterling effort as always. Thank you for your time this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks very much. Really enjoyed today.
Cheers, mate. And Matthew, thanks for wearing the captain's armband this week. A pleasure to chat to you once more.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
This podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.